Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. The big news should be in Chapel Hill about the effectiveness ratings of the North Carolina legislators. This is done every biennium, I guess, every 2 years by the North Carolina Center for Public Policy Research. We've asked its executive director, Rand Coble, to come over and tell us about it. And Rand, first of all, thanks for coming.
Glad to, always.
Secondly, can you explain to me why it isn't headline news that a resident of the Chapel Hill area who has been named the most effective legislator, most effective member of the House of Representatives, why that isn't such big news in Chapel Hill like it is sort of in the rest of the state? We're talking, of course, about Joe Hackney.
Well, I think part of it is Joe Hackney has been ranked among the five most effective legislators really for more than a decade. So the move from third to first probably doesn't look as big as a jump. But he became Speaker of the House in 2007 following a tumultuous sort of exit for Jim Black, who is now serving time in federal prison. And Hackney came in as somebody to clean up that mess, pass new ethics legislation, appoint entirely new committee chairs, put his team into place in terms of the leadership of the House. And I think that all of that to get combined got him to the number one spot in effectiveness in the House of Representatives, which is 120 members.
Does most effective mean best?
I don't know. Sort of best, you'd probably want to talk to a voter. Sometimes voters really care about particular issues and their stands on an issue, and so best to them means, did you vote the way I wanted you to vote? The reason that the founders of the center started this project back in 1977 was they thought, well, effective is a neutral concept. You can be an effective Republican, effective Democrat, effective conservative, effective liberal. It was a concept where you sort of knew what it meant. I mean, we give the voters some hints on what we think effectiveness is, but it basically comes down to the judgments of the three groups that we're asking to vote, and that is the legislators themselves, the lobbyists, and the Capital News media.
Well, you mentioned that it's nonpartisan, but there's some criticism from whichever party's out of power that to be effective, you have to be a part. It helps a lot be a part of the majority party, and that is something maybe that many citizens don't understand. How do you deal with that?
Well, I think there are two things. One, if I had to pick a single characteristic that matters the most in people moving up in the rankings, I think it's longevity. Regardless of which party you're in, you learn the people and the process, and the average person's going to move up probably 10 or 15 spots in the House and 8 to 12 in the Senate, you know, with each term that they're in the legislature.
If you're there for a long time, you can't sustain that rate,
but in the first
two or three sessions,
And so,
in other words, excuse me for interrupting you, but this is so interesting to me. In other words, if you're a voter and you're taking a look at your supervised ratings, that if you have a first-term legislator and you look and you see that that legislator is down in the bottom third, maybe don't worry too much about that because most, not all, but most first-term legislators are learning the ropes and watch them the second and third time.
I answered a question yesterday. A woman called me up and said, my representative is in 94. And I said, well, that's actually a little better than average for first-termers. They're usually in the 100 to 120 spot in the House. And then they're going to move up 80 to 100, you know, in their second term. And then the third term is where they might take their big jumps. And we can talk more about who made big jumps in the legislature this year, but you might expect them to be 60 to 80, and then the ones that are going to really move up and get some positions of power or influence. To go back to your other question too, DG, I think being in the majority gives you certain advantages. That is, you are more likely to get committee chairmanships and have more opportunities to be effective. On the other hand, their committee chairs ranked in the bottom 20 in the House and in the bottom 10 in the Senate. So it's not a guarantee. And there are people in the minority party who are in the top 10 in both chambers as well. So being in the majority, particularly now where there's a heavier majority compared to the mid-90s or late 90s, where either the Republicans were in power with a slim majority or the Democrats were in power with a slim majority, this session, you saw the end of that bipartisan coalition that was really governing, and therefore both parties were in power. I mean, you had Republican committee chairs and Democratic committee chairs. The end of that coalition meant that some of the Republicans who had been part of that coalition saw their rankings drop this time because they were resented by not the Democrats. They were resented by their fellow Republicans, and because the Republican caucus was really in an uproar. So a lot of factors going on. And that was one thing that made the rankings interesting to me this year. As you saw, you know, new leadership in the House. You saw the end of this coalition across party lines, Republicans and Democrats. And then you saw some people just make some huge jumps in their third term in the legislature. I think mostly because of natural ability and what they accomplished this session.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the Orange County and nearby legislators, mm-hmm. and maybe a little bit more about Joe Hackney, who I think it should be headline news in the Chapel Hill area that our representative, or the representative of many of us, is the most effective, has been judged by his colleagues to be the most effective legislator. On the other hand, it's automatic that the speaker's almost automatic that the speaker is going to be the most effective.
I'm glad you added because, almost, because, you know, we've done this 16 times since 1977, but there have been two speakers who were not ranked the most effective, and that became an issue for them.
How did that happen?
Well, in 1989 was the first time it happened, and that's when this coalition of Republicans and Democrats threw out then four-term speaker Liston Ramsey and put in Joe Mavrattic, and Mavrattic was not ranked the most effective legislator. He was really, you know, he finished not a distant second, but second to the then chairman of the Appropriations Committee, Dave Diamond.
I just backing up. This is probably, nobody else is probably interested in this, but that's such an interesting part of North Carolina history for me because I lived through it. But a lot of the, this is a question, but I'm going to put it as a statement, but a lot of the people who didn't vote for Joe Mavrattic to be the most effective weren't, he was the most effective, but he was also the one who made everybody the angriest people.
Well, he had strong supporters, and he pulled it off in terms of, he was most effective in getting a speaker out that they thought, that a lot of people thought had been there too long, Liston Ramsey, after 8 years, and a very sort of ruled the House with a small group of powerful legislators. On the other hand, Mavrattic made a lot of enemies, both within his own party and as he went during the session. He's sort of an irascible Marine, and you know, had a personality that sort of was confrontational.
Put myself in the mind of somebody who's voting and would say, well, maybe he was the most effective, but I'm not going to vote for that SOB because he's
well. That's part of being effective. Is you know, if you make people mad every time you speak up, then you know fewer of your bills are going to pass.
I can tell you've had this argument before. Now you mentioned that there was a second time that the speaker was. Do you remember what the other occasion?
Again, it was the second term that the Republicans had a majority in the House, second session, and Harold Brubaker was the second term Speaker of the House, and his Rules Committee Chairman, Richard Morgan, finished first that year. Morgan sort of, you know, controlled the flow of legislation that session, and people thought that he had jumped into sort of being the most effective. And so that also is the beginnings of this trouble within the Republican caucus, by the way. So it's sort of politics has history, and people have long memories in politics.
Sometimes it doesn't pay to be named the most effective because people...
Well,
a little jealousy.
It's how you use the power that ultimately probably means how long you're going to stay there. I mean, looking at Orange County's Joe Hackney, look at that record. I mean, since 1987, he's been in the top 10 in a 120-member House every session but 1995, when the Republicans had a fairly big majority. Hackney had lost all his committee chairmanships, you know, was in no position to influence legislation in a big minority, and yet still finished 16th in a 120-member House. Every other session since 1987, he's been in the top 10. So that tells you, I think his story in a way is illustrates the kind of point that your personal abilities and how hard you work really matter in the legislature. I mean, I can remember Joe Hackney was one of the first people to bring a computer into the General Assembly. And he would take notes on what the speaker was telling the committee. And then a session later, I heard him say something like, well, now last session you told us this, and now you're telling us this. And, you know, I just saw all the all his colleagues' eyebrows go up at that point. It's like, wow, this guy really does his homework. He's got a long memory. He's taking good notes. And that's the kind of thing that makes you, you know, most effective over time.
Well, I'm visiting with Rand Coble, and we're talking about the latest ratings of legislators' effectiveness, which has been compiled by the North Carolina Center for Public Policy Research, which Rand directs. And I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Rand Coble is my guest. Rand directs the North Carolina Center for Public Policy Research. And as a part of that group's mission, it compiles ratings of the effectiveness of North Carolina legislators based on the, I guess you'd say the votes are based on the rankings of all the legislators, a selection, all of the
registered lobbyists based in North Carolina. So if they're based in
North Carolina,
they're not going to vote.
And do you have the news people opted out of all of this?
No, the Capital News media are fewer now, and that's one change maybe to mention in the legislature. But all the Capital News media are also sent a survey. One difference, however, DG, is when I worked on the legislative staff in the early 70s, there were about 60 Capital News media. Now there are fewer than 15. Mm. So a whole lot less commitment to covering the legislature in terms of the news media.
Got a whole lot more reporters coming to cover the travel of the North Carolina, University of North Carolina basketball team to the NCAA semifinals. Than you would to cover anything that has to do with politics. It's a reflection of our interest. How about, we talked about Joe Hackney. Mm-hmm. Headline news is Chatham and Orange is Joe Hackney is the number one ranked most effective member of the House of Representatives. Let's talk about our other legislators and how they do and why they might be ranked as they are.
Okay. Of course, there are three people who represent Orange County. Joe Hackney, now the Speaker. Representative Verla Insko moved from 36th to 21st in the rankings out of 120 House members.
Which is a pretty significant.
That's a big jump
at that stage, because she's been there for quite some time. How do you explain that?
I think part of it is committee chair, and then part of it is she got two bills through that she's been working on for a long time. One was a bill on what is called mental health parity. But basically, it's to try to get, I guess it was 9 mental diseases treated the same for insurance purposes as you would a health problem. And that bill had come up probably 3 or 4 sessions in a row, and she got it passed this time. Another thing that she was heavily involved in was creating a high-risk health insurance pool for people who have more trouble getting health insurance. So the combination of committee chair, going back to your point about, power helps, but you got to do something with it. And here she's worked on those two bills for, 3 or 4 sessions, and she finally got both of them passed. And I think that had a big role in her making a pretty big jump.
Verla Insko's, I want to say this correctly. She's quiet, modest, moderate, not flashy, but seems to be a very hard worker and very committed person.
Yeah.
Sometimes you look for the people who shake the tree the hardest as being the leaders, and sometimes they don't turn out so well on the effectiveness
ratings. And that
ratings.
Also is one reason that I think it's valuable to have three different groups of people looking. The media, for example, tend to like the flashier or the people who are, well-spoken or who have colorful images, that are quotable. The fellow legislators tend to go for workhorses. The lobbyists probably you know, it matters to them sort of who helps them. I think the thing to remember there is I can't name an issue where there's not a countervailing lobbyist. And so it tends to even out when you're looking at 600 lobbyists. You know, if there's a lobbyist for an industry on this side, there's a lobbyist for somebody who's opposed to them on the other side.
I'm shocked by that number, 600. So you got 600 lobbyist voters.
That's a record number of people who were registered as lobbyists. Now, it is, I warn people against thinking, you know, that the halls are filled with 600 lobbyists every day, because the way the Secretary of State counts lobbyists is they double or triple count them depending on how many clients you represent. So if you had eight clients, you'd be registered eight different times in terms of the way they're counting. You know, we're not giving those people
eight ballots.
Votes. they're getting one ballot.
Well, what about some of our other legislators?
Well, Representative Bill Faison is in his second term now, and he moved up a slight amount from 59th to 54th. On the Senate side,
started out pretty good.
Yeah, he started out way high. Remember, a few minutes ago I said, you know, freshmen usually finish in that 100 to 120 range, and he started out at 59. So that's extremely good for a freshman. Off the top of my head, that might have been the highest freshman in the his first session. On the Senate side, you have Senator Robert Atwater, who represents part of this district. He's from Chatham County, but he represents part of Orange as well. He made the biggest jump in the 50-member Senate of all but one person. He moved up eight spots from 42nd to 34th, so not bad for a second-termer, and particularly in terms of the move up.
Although that is a – let's talk about the Senate for just a minute, since you mentioned what the – a potential rise is in the Senate. The Senate is
much harder. Much
50
harder.
People, and the leadership is, or has been, hadn't
entrenched.
Moved as quickly. Entrenched. I don't want to be caught with the right words. But anyway, it's stable. Maybe that would be the word.
Well.
So it's harder
to move.
To get a important committee assignment, and to you have to be there for a longer time,
yeah.
I guess.
I mean, you look at the president pro tem of the Senate, Mark Besnight, has been president pro tem for eight sessions and has been ranked number one, now a record-shattering eighth time. I think what's also unusual is his leadership team also has stayed in place over that time. Tony Rand, who is the majority leader and rules committee chair, has been there five sessions as part of Besnight's team. He's second this time. The appropriations co-chairs, though two of them are running for higher office this year, so some things are going to open up next session. But those three committee chairs who handle the appropriations in the state budget, Kay Hagan, Dan Clodfelter, and Linda Guru, Hagan from Greensboro, Guru from Winston-Salem, and Clodfelter from Charlotte, you know, that group has been at the top a long time. And then the other Appropriations Committee co-chair, Walter Dalton, has been at the top as well a long time. Dalton is running for lieutenant governor this year. Hagan is running for the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate. And so two of those spots are going to open up in terms of move up in the Senate. But overall, the Senate has less turnover, and it has a more stable leadership team. And I think that makes it harder to move up and to break into those committee chairs, and therefore any move up of Senator Atwater's is significant to move up eight spots in a 50-member Senate where there's less opportunity because of that stability or entrenched leaderships, depending on which wording you pick.
Well, our other senator, our
principal senator representing Orange County,
is Ellie Kinnaird, and is ranked in your effectiveness ranking in this year 27th, which is where she's been for
third session in a row.
Yeah, the third session in a row. So I don't want to, you know, we've already explained why people might get stuck sort of in their rating because there's not much movement at the top. What else? I guess let me just say that this has sort of become an issue in the Democratic primary here about Ellie's strength, her supporters would say, is that she stands up to the establishment and that represents the values of her constituents, even if at the risk of offending or not being in step with the rest of the body. And her opponents might would say, you got to get along to get things done. Mm-hmm. How does the standing up for the right, how is that measured by the people who participate in this effectiveness study?
I think that's something where I say to people, you know, the rankings are not the only things you should consider. I mean, I don't think these are the end all and be all of a legislator's performance from a district's eyes, that you need to look at the district and see how well people feel represented. To put it in this particular example, I think Senator Kinnaird probably is both from a more liberal district and a more liberal senator than most of her fellow senators. So that's one factor. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing, and this is true for her and for several of the people, is she announced that she was not going to run for the Senate again, and had took that stance through most of the session. And people who did that, Representative George Holmes, for example, on the House side, a Republican from Yadkin area, Yadkin Valley area, you know, several people who sort of said, "I'm not running again," went down.
So you become a quote lame duck, and you lose a little bit of your edge,
in the eyes of your fellow legislators. Now, Senator Kinnaird changed her mind and is now running for the Democratic nomination for her Senate district. But I do think that matters in terms of, you know, if people think they aren't going to have to deal with you next session, that can affect how they vote in the rankings.
Well,
I think.
We're visiting with Rand Coble. Rand is telling us a little bit about the effectiveness rankings for members of the North Carolina General Assembly. This is a project of the North Carolina Center for Public Policy Research, which Rand directs, and he and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Headline news in Chapel Hill should be, our representative is ranked number one. Joe Hackney is the most effective member of the North Carolina House, according to the effectiveness rankings recently released by the North Carolina Center for Public Policy Research. Rand Coble, its executive director, has come to talk about it. And Rand, nobody would argue, certainly you wouldn't argue, that these effectiveness ratings are perfectly done, scientifically done, but you must wrestle with the question of how you can be as effective as possible and as fair as possible. Mm-hmm. And so from time to time, you must make changes in the way you do things.
Yeah. And one other thing we do, DG, is this is not the only sort of measure of legislators' performance that we issue. So in this same booklet where we're asking those legislators, lobbyists, and media to rank effectiveness, we're also publishing attendance rankings, how often the legislators were there, how many legislative days were there. We published their participation and roll call votes, because you can be there and not go to the chamber and vote. And so some people who were and that's a very interesting difference to me as far as sort of being in the building versus choosing to take a walk, for example, and maybe not choosing to vote on a controversial bill or just missing some important days where, I mean, some people were absent a legislative day, but they were lucky and it wasn't a day that the legislature took any votes. So those are three measures that are in this same book. Then in the odd-numbered years, we publish for all the members of the legislature who came back, we publish what we call bill success ratios. And that is, how many bills did you introduce and how many got passed? And so that's sort of your ratio of success in passing bills in the legislature. And then lastly, as
I'll
part of this...
I'll just stop you on that, because you might be saying, well, so what? But I think many of us who have not had experience with the legislature don't really cannot appreciate how difficult it is to get a bill passed. Mm-hmm.
Maybe a third or a fourth of the bills in a session might pass.
Yeah, maybe, and
out
maybe
2,500 bills.
Yeah, and maybe fewer than that. Is that what it is? I'm surprised that many, having watched.
Depends on the session.
Yeah, right. Having watched so many people struggle to get good bills passed. Maybe that's the subject for another program, but if you think it's easy to get a bill passed, if you think your legislator just because you got a good idea
of
something ought to be
done.
Easier to stop one than it is.
So that's a fourth measure. And then the fifth measure is, as part of this effectiveness survey, we asked the legislators and lobbyists and media, what do you think were the 12 most important bills in the last session that you had before you? And then we published the votes for every legislator who was there the previous session on those bills. So in total, the center's given you five different measures of legislator performance: effectiveness, attendance, roll call voting participation, that bill success ratio, and the votes on what the legislators said were the most 12 important bills.
Might be some issues that would be important to you, and you could see how your legislator. At least you could have some questions to raise with your legislator about that.
Now, would you like me to sort of also talk about what we ask people to consider in ranking effectiveness?
Yeah, do that.
And that's where the change comes in.
Yeah.
Because we haven't made many changes, but we made one this year, and it did, I think, show up in the rankings. There's a paragraph in the survey that says, when you're ranking each legislator's effectiveness, consider these things. And it's skill at guiding bills through committee, how good they are in floor debates, their expertise in special fields. Do they know a lot about the environment or economic development or the tax structure? The respect that they have from their peers, their personal skills, their ability to sway the opinions of fellow legislators. And this year we added his or her ethics. And the person who dropped the most in the House and who finished last in the House is Representative Thomas Wright, who, when this survey was taken, he had not been expelled from the House and he had not been convicted of corruption. And so the legislators knew there was a problem when they voted. And Thomas Wright finished in 119 out of 120 House members, and that 120th member resigned at the end of the session, and so he was not included in this survey.
Well, it's, that is such an interesting story, the Thomas Wright story, as it relates to effectiveness rankings, because Thomas Wright was in the top group, in the top.
Under Speaker Jim Black, he was part of the leadership team.
Top 15, sometimes as high as 8th in effectiveness. He was, in many respects, viewed by all of us, including me, I have to say, as a comer, as somebody who had all of the qualities that you mentioned as for effectiveness, save only this last one. But we didn't know about that. Didn't. He projected someone who cared about doing the right thing and being ethical. And the same thing ran with Speaker Black. He's not on your list anymore because he resigned early in the session, but he would have been ranked at the top in prior years, and this year, had he been on the list, had the rankings been taken before he resigned, he would have been.
Well, of course, he was out really before the session started. So he would not have been included under any measure. That's always a tough issue, by the way, is you do have legislators that die in office or that come in late in the session and so we have to make a decision as to what the cutoff point is as far as putting them in the rankings or excluding them.
He left early in the session, but he was sworn in and got started. But it is, you have to make those judgments, and nobody would argue that he should have been included in this session. But the I guess I don't know what the point I want to make is, other than that the fortunes of legislators can go up and down,
rise
precipitously,
and
that the thing that gets them the quickest is an ethical lapse that is caught.
And I think that's also true of the rankings we do of most influential lobbyists, DG, is the principal thing that you have as an asset in the legislature is the trust of the people that you're working with. And if they lose their trust in you, either as a fellow legislator or a legislator's trust in a lobbyist, you have lost that forever, probably, or it'll be a hard row to hoe to get it back. And I think that's an underestimated commodity in the legislative process.
That's such an important point. And the I wish I had the words to describe it, but it's not in this case. It is not altogether just the sort of ethical stance that you and I think of as being important. That is, do you take bribes,
or did you violate a law?
It is from a lobbyist standpoint. If you have a conversation with the legislator and there's a misunderstanding that develops about whether or not that person is going to be able to support you or to take a lead role in helping you with the bill or helping you with another legislator, and that you come away with the impression that the legislator is totally committed to your effort, mm-hmm. and it turns out that he's or she is saying the same thing to the opposing side just because he wants to be liked by everybody.
Yeah.
And that is the same – that degree – of trustworthiness in mm-hmm. dealing with the legislative issues has the same degree, I think, of influence as actual, maybe, as actual ethics do.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. If you say, to a fellow legislator or to a lobbyist, yes, I plan to vote for this bill, and then you go on the floor and vote against it, they remember that. If a lobbyist gives you only one part of the story and says, the legislator asks, well, is there any opposition to the bill? And the lobbyist either lies or isn't a very good lobbyist and says no. And then all of a sudden the legislator gets hit with, 100 emails or protesting constituents from the realtors or home builders or whatever, then the legislator loses trust in the lobbyist. And so trust is a valuable commodity, and it is the principal asset that you really have in dealing in a very human process, in terms of passing legislation. Yeah. You've got to trust each other. You're never going to be on the same side with everybody. And, there's never a session where you're not going to have some really controversial votes that you really are troubled by. And so you've got to have trust in what people say they want to do.
It's the way I would rank legislators is are trying to be fair, because some of them, I've had to fight, and some have just rescued me at every point. But I guess I would say I would line up the ones that I wanted on my side if I had a really tough issue.
Uh-huh.
Who would I choose first to be on my team, mm-hmm. and then who would I choose mm-hmm. second and third? And it would be we talked about what does it mean to be effective. It is who I would choose to be my supporters if I had the choice, if I had a tough issue.
Sure, like who you want in the foxhole with.
Yeah, right. Well, Rand Coble, who directs the North Carolina Center for Public Policy Research, and I are talking about one of the center's most recent projects, and that's the effectiveness rankings of North Carolina members of the North Carolina House of Representatives and Senate. He and I'll be right back to talk about some of the other things that are on his mind and other things that the center is working on. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. Our guest is Rand Coble. Rand is the executive director of the North Carolina Center for Public Policy Research. He and I have been talking about this really interesting project, and I get excited. Who's number one in terms of the most effective legislators, and if you joined us late, the most effective member of the House of Representatives, judged by his colleagues in the House and the Capitol Press Corps and the lobbyist. The consensus ranking is that Joe Hackney is the most effective member of the current legislature. But, Rand, horse races get a lot of attention, and this gets y'all, the Center for Public Policy Research, a lot of attention because we do like to rank people. But are you doing anything else?
Oh, yes. I'm glad you asked. We've got we publish a magazine called North Carolina Insight, and we try to every once in a while do theme issues where we really go in depth. And the next issue of Insight is going to look at the future of the community college system in North Carolina. We've already done a public event on this, and by the way, people can see that on cable TV during the night. It's showing all across the state in the Triangle area. It's Time Warner Cable Channel 24, and it's on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. Actually, I saw it on Thursday as well last week.
You're getting a lot of play.
So that's good. But what we're looking at is, you know, if you think about, well, what's the thing that bothers you most of what North Carolina's experiencing? I would say it's this economic transition that we're going through from away from the old economy of tobacco, textiles, and furniture, and toward this new economy of biotechnology, pharmaceuticals, telecommunications, computers, you know, who knows what our new economy is really going to end up being after we go through this period of economic trials and tribulations. But I think the community colleges are really a key to that economic transition. I think the community colleges, based on our research and just sort of looking at numbers, they're also probably the key to dealing with some workforce shortages in key areas like producing teachers and nurses and allied health officials. And, you know, I was surprised to find we've also got a shortage of truck drivers and utility company linemen, which the community colleges also supply. So that's what's coming up in terms of one.
So you're looking at the community colleges from the standpoint of how capable, under the current organizational structure, they are to respond to these needs.
And we'll be looking at governance as well. But this is, I would say, the principal question we're trying to ask is everything from the formulas which fund community colleges to the faculty pay, comparing that nationally, to workforce development, which is one of the principal missions of the community college system, to remedial education. You know, a lot of kids who drop out of high school, they're going to end up, you know, in the community college system in terms of trying to complete some education or get training for a job, to job retraining. All the workers who've lost their jobs when Cannon Mills closed, they went straight to the community college. So this is really a pretty comprehensive look at the mission of the community college.
Well, now you're looking at mission. And what's wrong with the mission as you see it in terms of facing the new sort of the challenges of the new economy?
I don't think, you know, we're far enough in where I can say I think our conclusion is there's nothing wrong with the mission. There are some things wrong with, say, funding formulas. For example, community colleges are funded for full-time equivalent students, but it's based on last year's enrollment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, when you have an economic downturn, everybody runs the community college system, and you've got last year's funding, but you've got, you know, 1,000 more students or something.
Well, how can you address that? I mean, you got a budget. I mean, even if you're doing it on anticipated enrollment, that's based on current enrollment. How do you address the need for flexible funding?
Stay tuned.
I'll listen to that.
I'll
the other
tease
thing,
you a little bit.
All right.
But that's an obvious problem. You also got a faculty that you know is 46th or 44th in pay nationally among the 50 states. And you know, if that's your principal way of dealing with an economic transition, you want to. I mean, nurses tell us, well, I would love to teach in a community college, but I can earn more working in a hospital than I can as a faculty member for community college, and so you're going to have a hard time getting nurses.
The I'm interested in this, and I've just come back from listening to the president of Arizona State University talk about kind of the dramatic reformation of higher education in his university, which is shocking. But his point basically is that if we're not limber and prepared to respond to the current and anticipated challenges of the future, we basically are wasting the public's money. And the challenge, of course, it was in the higher education field, but when you talk about the barriers to quick response in the university, notwithstanding the tremendous efforts of the current president to address those, that the community colleges, also bound in tradition and politics, maybe even more than the university, they have this newness that permits them to reform quickly and to address, a task force response type thing that's tougher in the university
system. They're pretty nimble.
I guess what I'm saying is that if you live in Chapel Hill and you're dependent on the University of North Carolina, while I don't want to ever say that the community colleges are a threat, but it is possible that the community colleges might be in a better position to help the state respond to the current transition than the universities are, and so watch out.
Yeah, and there are 58 of them, and people, in terms of political loyalty, I think the community colleges have a tremendous reservoir of political loyalty to them in their local communities, because they are really tied to those communities.
Was it going to cost us a lot? Are your recommendations going to cost us a lot of money?
I'm going to just hold that one too. Stay tuned in the second week in May.
Was there anything you do want to talk about?
Well, the other thing we're looking at in both communities, colleges and in universities is student financial aid, and sort of what that situation is, given both increases in tuition, but also sort of some radical changes at the national level. And so that'll be a new thing coming out of the center. And then the other part of this project we've spent most of our time on today is we'll release the rankings of the most influential lobbyists as ranked by the
legislators. And that'll be changed because we had some upsets in aging out in that area. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that and looking forward to following the work of the center. I we're out of time, but not all the way out of time, so that I can thank you for taking the time to come visit us in Chapel Hill. And Rand Coble, thanks for the work that the North Carolina Center for Public Policy Research does in keeping us fixed on the prize. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.